That night he could not sleep. He lay awake thinking of the Junkers 88s and of the hardness of the water. He could think of nothing else. They were JU-88s, he said to himself. I know they were. And yet it is not possible, because they would not be flying around so low over here in broad daylight. I know that it is true, and yet I know that it is impossible. Perhaps I'm ill. Perhaps I am behaving like a fool and do not know what I am doing or saying. Perhaps I am delirious. For a long time, he lay awake thinking these things, and once he sat up in bed and said aloud, I will prove that I am not crazy. I will make a little speech about something complicated and intellectual. I will talk about what to do with Germany after the war. But before he had time to begin, he was asleep. He woke just as the first light of day was showing through the slit in the curtains over the window. The room was still dark, but he could tell that it was already beginning to get light outside. He lay looking at the grey light which was showing through the slit in the curtain, and as he lay there, he remembered the day before. He remembered the Junkers 88s and the hardness of the water. He remembered the large, pleasant nurse and the kind doctor, and now the small grain of doubt took root in his mind and it began to grow. He looked around the room. The nurse had taken the roses out the night before, and there was nothing except the table with a packet of cigarettes, a box of matches, and an ashtray. Otherwise, it was bare. It was no longer warm or friendly. It was not even comfortable. It was cold and empty and very quiet. Slowly, the grain of doubt grew, and with it came fear, a light, dancing fear that warned but did not frighten. The kind of fear that one gets, not because one is afraid, but because one feels that there is something wrong. Quickly, the doubt and the fear grew, so that he became restless and angry. And when he touched his forehead with his hand, he found that it was damp with sweat. He knew then that he must do something, that he must find some way of proving to himself that he was either right or wrong. And he looked up and saw again the window and the green curtains. From where he lay, that window was right in front of him, but it was fully 10 yards away. Somehow he must reach it and look out. The idea became an obsession with him, and soon he could think of nothing else except the window. But what about his leg? He put his hand underneath the bedclothes and felt the thick, bandaged stump, which was all that was left on the right-hand side. It seemed all right. It didn't hurt, but it would not be easy. He sat up. Then he pushed the bedclothes aside and put his left leg on the floor. Slowly, he swung his body over until he had both hands on the floor as well. And then he was out of bed, kneeling on the carpet. He looked at the stump. It was very short and thick, covered with bandages. It was beginning to hurt, and he could feel it throbbing. He wanted to collapse, lie down on the carpet and do nothing, but he knew that he must go on. With two arms and one leg, he crawled over towards the window. He would reach forward as far as he could with his arms, then he would give a little jump and slide his left leg along after them. Each time he did, it jarred his wound so that he gave a soft grunt of pain. But he continued to crawl across the floor on two hands and one knee. When he got to the window, he reached up, and one at a time he placed both hands on the sill. Slowly he raised himself up until he was standing on his left leg. Then quickly he pushed aside the curtains and looked out. He saw a small house with a grey tiled roof standing alone beside a narrow lane, and immediately behind it was a ploughed field. In front of the house there was an untidy garden, and there was a green hedge separating the garden from the lane. He was looking at the hedge when he saw the sign. It was just a piece of board nailed to the top of a short pole, and because the hedge had not been trimmed for a long time, the branches had grown out around the sign, so that it seemed almost as though it had been placed in the middle of the hedge. There was something written on the board with white paint, and he pressed his head against the glass of the window, trying to read what it said. The first letter was G. He could see that. The second was an A, and the third was an R. One after another, he managed to see what the letters were. There were three words, and slowly he spelled the letters out aloud to himself as he managed to read them. G-A-R-E-D-E-A-U-C-H-I-E-N. Garde au chien. That is what it said. He stood there, balancing on one leg and holding tightly to the edges of the windowsill with his hands, staring at the sign and at the whitewashed lettering of the words. For a moment, he could think of nothing at all. He stood there, looking at the sign, repeating the words over and over to himself. And then slowly, he began to realize the full meaning of the thing. He looked up at the cottage and at the ploughed field. He looked at the small orchard on the left of the cottage, and he looked at the green countryside beyond. "So this is France," he said. "I'm in France." Now the throbbing of his right thigh was very great. It felt as though someone was pounding the end of his stump with a hammer. And suddenly the pain became so intense that it affected his head, and for a moment he thought he was going to fall. Quickly he knelt down again, crawled back to the bed and hoisted himself in. He pulled the bedclothes over himself and lay back on the pillow, exhausted. He could still think of nothing at all except the small sign by the hedge and the ploughed field and the orchard. It was the words on the sign that he could not forget. It was some time before the nurse came in. She came carrying a basin of hot water, and she said, "Good morning, how are you today?" He said, "Good morning, nurse." The pain was still great under the bandages, but he did not wish to tell this woman anything. He looked at her as she busied herself with getting the washing things ready. He looked at her more carefully now. Her hair was very fair. She was tall and big-boned, and her face seemed pleasant. But there was something a little uneasy about her eyes. They were never still. They never looked at anything for more than a moment, and they moved too quickly from one place to another in the room. There was something about her movements also. They were too sharp and nervous to go well with the casual manner in which she spoke. She set down the basin, took off his pajama top, and began to wash him. "Did you sleep well?" "Yes." Good, she said. She was washing his arms and his chest. I believe there's someone coming down to see you from the Air Ministry after breakfast, she went on. They want a report or something. I expect you know all about it, how you got shot down and all that. I won't let him stay long, so don't worry. He did not answer. She finished washing him and gave him a toothbrush and some tooth powder. He brushed his teeth, rinsed his mouth, and spat the water out into the basin. Later, she brought him breakfast on a tray, but he did not want to eat. He was still feeling weak and sick, and he wished only to lie still and think about what had happened. And there was a sentence running through his head. It was a sentence which Johnny, the intelligence officer of his squadron, always repeated to the pilots every day before they went out. He could see Johnny now, leaning against the window of the dispersal hut with his pipe in his hand, saying, "And if they get you, don't forget just your name, rank and number. Nothing else. For God's sake, say nothing else." "There you are," she said, as she put the tray on his lap. "I've got an egg. Can you manage all right?" "Yes." She stood beside the bed. "Are you feeling all right?" "Yes." "Good. If you want another egg, I might be able to get you one." "Oh, this is all right. Well, just ring the bell if you want any more." And she went out. He had just finished eating when the nurse came in again. She said, "Wing Commander Roberts is here. I've told him that he can stay only a few minutes." She beckoned with her hand, and the wing commander came in. "Sorry to bother you like this," he said. He was an ordinary RAF officer, dressed in a uniform which was a little shabby, and he wore wings and a DFC. He was fairly tall and thin, with plenty of black hair. His teeth, which were irregular and widely spaced, stuck out a little even when he closed his mouth. As he spoke, he took a printed form and a pencil from his pocket and pulled up a chair and sat down. "How are you feeling?" There was no answer. "Tough luck about your leg. I know how you feel. I hear you put up a fine show before they got you." The man in the bed was lying quite still, watching the man in the chair. The man in the chair said, "Well, let's get this stuff over. I'm afraid you'll have to answer a few questions so that I can fill in this combat report. Let me see now. First of all, what was your squadron?" The man in the bed did not move. He looked straight at the wing commander and he said, "My name is Peter Williamson. My rank is squadron leader and my number is 972457.